and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again as we go up and down the Smoky Mountains as the Tennessee Stud shares wrestling history with all of us each and every week. Without any further ado, let's get to him right now. The man of the hour, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, you've been building this one up. This is a big one, but let me ask you first, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Doing really good, Brian. And, ready to go, my man. And this one, I really believe fans are going to enjoy this. They're going to get a little bit of everything today. I'm just ready to roll whenever you are.
Well, hold on. Before you ride off on lightning, let me just say a couple things here at the top of the show. Want to thank everyone. Thank everyone for listening. We got a lot of new listeners, but also want to thank all the patrons who have been so supportive of what we've been doing with the Studcast and all the bonus content that we put up there on Patreon. And of course, I want to mention that Super Studcast number 18, part one is up now. And that is part one with former NWA World Champion Ron Garvin. You may know him as Ron Garvin. You may know him as Rugged Ronnie Garvin. You may know him as the One Man Gang, Hands of Stone, Fist of Stone. This man has more nicknames than the Tennessee Stud himself. And you can hear this right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Over 90 minutes with Ron Garvin, and we talk about his entire career. We touch on Knoxville, but we have a big surprise coming for everyone with part two. We're going to really go in-depth on the Knoxville Wrestling War with Ron Garvin. We're going to have someone from the Southeastern side, someone from the All-Star side, the Tennessee Stud, and Rugged Ronnie Garvin together talking about the Knoxville Wrestling War. You're going to want to hear this. But until then, listen to part one. Listen to the history of Ron Garvin in the wrestling industry. I think everyone's going to really, really love this episode. I know we really loved being a part of it. We talked off air about how good it was, and I think everyone else will like it. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. But Ron, where are we going today on the Studcast?
We got a great one today, Brian. I'm going to call this a kind of a special Studcast. It's going to cover four very important back-to-back days in my life in late April of 1975. And during this Studcast, I'm going to wear all four different hats that I wear because I own a company and I'm a promoter, a booker, and a wrestler. And I'm going to wear all those hats during this 4 day period. And I put on my booker hat for the first night because I'm not on the card Friday, April 25th, 1975. It's a tag team tournament night, special one that comes to Chilhowee Park in Knoxville, to decide who is going to wrestle one of the, key matches in that, Sunday card 2 days later. We're going to cover the next day, a Saturday morning, April 26th. A television day, and that time I get to put on my booker and my promoter hat. And the third day is a 3 p.m. start for the Coliseum, the third Coliseum show, which is going to require both hats, booker and wrestler hat. And we'll cover all the aspects of this great event, this third Coliseum show. Then the following morning on April 28th, 1975, I've got my promoter hat, and I'm going to wear my owner's hat, which I rarely had the opportunity to do. And I'm going to make the most important proposal in my life at this point so far, to make an attempt to move my Southeastern Wrestling TV show from the weakest television station in the market to the strongest television station there. And during the last part of today's studcast, I'm going to take the fans into a beautiful conference room at the of the television station, the largest one in Knoxville, WBIR. And I'm going to do my best to recreate everything that went into this television station presentation. So that's why I've got on my owner hat that day. And I'm going to try to present it as pretty much exactly as I can remember how I conveyed it to him. And even though I didn't know at the time, this meeting probably saved Southeastern Wrestling, because I think Big Jim Hess was pushing my present station to drop Southeastern Wrestling from their lineup. And then I will finish that Monday night after this meeting in the morning. I'm going to get on a plane and fly across the state. And I'm going to wrestle Jack Briscoe for the second time in 2 days. And it's basically four life-changing days in the hectic life of a 26-year-old young businessman with a very different occupation and a company that and a different type of company than most anybody on the planet owns, a wrestling company. So we're gonna touch a lot of bases today. We're going to talk a lot of different things about wrestling itself, the promotion part, the matches, and we're going to get into a little bit of stuff that owners handle when they're actually talking to television stations and trying to set those things up.
Well, it sounds like we have one of the most packed episodes we've ever had, Ron. Let's start. I guess you mentioned the third Coliseum show. You mentioned the Friday night show 2 days before it, April 25th at Chilhowee Park, outdoors for the first time of the year in 1975. But let's go to the Coliseum show. What was the lineup for this show?
Yeah, it's kind of all pieced together here. And at this point, by the time that Friday night goes through, we know exactly what all the matches are going to be. So on the Coliseum show on Sunday, April 27th, the opening match was scheduled to be Steve Kovacs versus the British Butcher. Then there's a Tennessee Tag Championship with champions Ron and Don Bass, managed by Sam Bass, against Jerry Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto, a team from Memphis that's been coming in pretty regularly. Third match was a non-title match with Georgia heavyweight champion Jerry Briscoe on the card versus my brother Robert Fuller. So there's two Briscoes and two Fullers on this card, and they're both wrestling against each other, both wrestling for the Southeastern for their first time. Jerry Briscoe and Robert, it's their first time ever wrestle for Southeastern. Fourth match is Ron Wright against the Mongolian Stomper, managed by Bearcat Wright. And it's that heels combination first time to wrestle in Southeastern. The fifth match was the Southern Tag Championship with champions George Barnes and Bill Dundee facing the winners of the tag tournament on the Friday night 2 days earlier with Jimmy Golden and Les Thatcher. And the main event, obviously, is the NWA World Championship with Jack Briscoe defending against me for my first world title match in Knoxville. Before we give the results, let's back up one day to Saturday and discuss the TV show that supports this big world championship the next afternoon. We talked a little bit in the previous studcast about the 25th date, that Friday night that had the tag tournament and all that. So this is the day following the tag tournament. Jimmy Golden and Les Thatcher won the tournament. In that tournament, there was a Southern heavyweight tag championship match in which Dundee and Barnes were actually in Knoxville and on that same card. I did not wrestle on that Friday night prior to the Sunday match. Maybe because I'm thinking I'm wrestling Jack Briscoe twice in a row, and I probably better take care of myself and maybe take a little bit of rest on Friday night. So we'll talk first about this TV show. It's the day before the Coliseum show. And I'd filmed the finals of the one-night tag tournament on Friday night at Chilhowee Park Amphitheater. We were outside. Beautiful night, too. No rain. Jimmy Golden and Les Thatcher had won the tournament and the right to face the Southern Tag Champions, the Aussies, Barnes and Dundee. I'd also filmed an interview with the Aussie champions and opened the TV that day, on this Saturday, with Golden and Thatcher getting a big win. And then they go to the desk with my trusty commentator, and I say that in jest, believe me, hoping to get decent comments and remarks from Big Jim Hess concerning these two stars' match for the Southern Tag titles. When they arrived at the desk, Hess starts to play the film interview from the night before with the Aussies, but cannot help to remark after it plays, how did two Australians get to be Southern Tag Champions? I think that was his question. It was something to that effect. And I guess it was the only negative remark that he could think of off the top of his head. And thankfully, Jimmy jumped right in to cover up for Hess's smart remark by explaining to the, I'm going to call him the dumbass, that Jimmy's being in Australia. Jimmy had been to Australia and had taught him a lot about these two Aussie champions, and they were certainly qualified to be tag champions anywhere in the world. Thatcher covered up for Hess as well, explaining how impressed he was watching them the night before. He had never had a chance to see them wrestle and how difficult they would be to defeat on tomorrow afternoon, well, on the Sunday afternoon card. After the segment closed, I thanked both Golden and Thatcher in the back for covering up for Big Jim's lousy remark, and I thanked him right in front of Big Jim to let him know that, hey, you're not getting by with anything anymore, man. And he just kind of got red in his face. I could see him squirm around. You know, I was like, gosh, I mean, he didn't have to bring that up right in front of them. Well, he didn't have to say it on live on TV either. So I'm still having this big problem with Big Jim, obviously.
I want to ask you about Robert, because this is now, what, 6 months after you have purchased Knoxville, started Southeastern. How many times did you call Robert or contact Robert to come in? Now that he is here, were you hoping that you would win him over, or had he already agreed that he was going to be there full time?
No, he's, and I don't think he really is going to stay this time full time. And I had not called him and asked him to be on any shows. But I got to looking at this world championship card with me wrestling Jack and with Jerry being the Georgia heavyweight champion in this time frame, and he's only 200 miles away from Knoxville. I couldn't hardly resist it, bringing Jerry in. And then I thought, well, geez, if I'm going to bring Jerry in, why don't I bring my brother to wrestle Jack's brother? And, you know, I thought that was a pretty good little deal to be able to pull that off. And Rob says, yeah, I'll come in. I'll work with him. And Rob is going to work a few shows here, but I'm not sure that Rob is staying at this point. But I did want to have him come in. I wanted him to see what's going on. I wanted him not to come into Chihuahua Park or into the amphitheater out there his first time with Southeastern. I wanted him to come into a big event in the big building. And I think that was impressive for him because he had never been in that Coliseum before. And and then in this next segment, the second segment of the television show, Hess is feeling more at home because his old buddy Ron Wright was returning to the ring on TV that day and then went to the desk to watch a film match from Memphis with his opponent for the next day, another guy who's never been there before, never been seen in Knoxville. And I don't think Ron Wright had ever seen him even. He's gonna watch a film from Memphis with the Mongolian Stomper. And you can tell Ron Wright, I could tell by the way he watched the film and started off with his comments like usual. And then I you could almost hear how impressed he was with this guy. You know, I was like, wow, this guy looks pretty darn good. You know, it wasn't a typical Ron Wright interview. He was almost backing up a little bit because, wow, I've never seen this guy. This guy's pretty, you know, he even called him a physical specimen. Big word for Ron. You know, he's calling the Stomper the physical specimen, and certainly Stomper was. Even Big Jim seemed to be impressed by asking Ron toward the end of the interview. He says, are you sure, Ron, you're ready for that guy? You know, like he really put the emphasis on that guy, you know. I mean, then they showed a great interview from Bearcat Wright, who was the Stomper's manager. Stomper always had managers back in those days. He didn't like to do his own talking. And Bearcat Wright was a pretty decent wrestler and a darn good interviewer. And when Bearcat Wright's interview showed where he was talking about Ron Wright, he just spent the whole time talking about destroying Ron Wright, the hillbilly up there in Knoxville. And I've brought the guy that destroys them all. And the Stomper really had that great look, and obviously he was really, really impressive. Then the great Ron Wright, he started into his Tennessee dog whipping, by gosh, and that's what he did at his best. And he set the stage for a real battle, basically, against him and a very scary opponent. And I say that literally because I've had my, the first time I wrestled Stomper, I had a feeling that, God, this guy is pretty much an awesome individual and capable of doing anything. So, and the great thing about this whole second segment, it gave Hess no opportunity to screw up. And I was getting very happy about the way this show was progressing. I'm getting not much backlash out of my commentator.
How did you go about booking the Mongolian Stomper for his first appearance in Knoxville? And of course, he would become one of the biggest stars you ever had and one of the biggest stars Knoxville ever had. Was it that you saw him in Bearcat in Memphis and you got to know them? How did you go about booking him for the first time in Knoxville?
Yeah, and that's really the reason. He was working for Jarrett. And I watched his match. You know, I met him in the dressing room like you do in all territories. As you go in, you shake hands with new people. And I shook hands and introduced myself. And I was impressed. You know, I mean, God, there's not many guys that have the look of Stomper. Had. So I couldn't hardly wait to get him on something in Knoxville, but I really wanted to put him on a big card. And so this was perfect. It was my opportunity to bring him in the Coliseum and to have a bunch of new fans be able to see somebody as impressive as he was. So it worked out good for me. And as you say, we don't get locked up and hooked up right away. It's going to be actually a couple of years almost down the road before he's actually going to come and stay. But I wanted him. I would have loved to had him right then, but I was not in a position yet. We weren't drawing big enough crowds to be able to keep a guy with that kind of talent. So the third segment of this TV show was another live tag match with Ron and Don Bass. We were a great team, managed by Sam Bass, and obviously they got a win. And then they came back to the desk to watch an interview from the night before with Jerry Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto, who had been in that tournament on the Friday night. I was smart enough to get an interview with those two guys that I could show on my TV the next day because they're going back to Memphis to work on television there. Their interview was about the Tennessee Tag Championship defense the following afternoon. And the Basses were very professional, and they kept Big Jim's mouth shut as they didn't give him opportunity to say anything. Sam Bass was a pretty decent interviewer, and Sam walked all over him a couple of times. He wanted to interrupt, and Sam just cut him off right away. And I was kind of happy with that. I said, yeah, that's a good deal. Just keep at it, Sam. Don't give him any opportunity to mess things up.
What was the next segment on the show, Ron?
It was all about the world title match, obviously. We're down now to the end of the program. We're going to talk about the main event for the card the next afternoon at 3 o'clock. And I was obviously joined by my renegade commentator. I went to the desk, and Gordon Solie had sent me a copy of the world title match where Jack had won the championship from Harley Race in Houston. And then we played the interview. Gordon had gotten cut for me in Tampa with Jack himself, talking about the Sunday afternoon match with me. I don't think Big Jim said hardly a word in the entire segment, and I finished out the segment with my comments. Jack really put me over in his interview, and I focused on my family's history in the sport. I thought that was important for a world championship match in a city in which I now called home. And I discussed being a part of the largest sport and the largest wrestling family in the sport and how I was born and bred to be the NWA world champion. I followed that statement with how sad it was that I had this opportunity in a place like Knoxville and how I would be embarrassed to win the title in hillbilly heaven like Knoxville, but I'm going to win it anyway, in spite of where it's at, you know. So that really kind of set the stage. I was already a heel, and I'm certainly not making it any easier for fans to like me. So, and then in the case, Jack Briscoe is a babyface champion, and this doesn't happen very often where you've got a babyface champion. And I'm really taking full advantage of that. Jack's made one of those wonderful interviews, and he's just very low key, and fans always love Jack's look. And now I go out and just, I make fun of Knoxville and all the fans and everything else. So we got it in a good spot now. And we're all going to find out 3 o'clock the next afternoon just how far Southeastern Wrestling has come in its first 6 months. No doubt about that. 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon or on Sunday afternoon, we're going to know how we're doing.
Well, let's get to that show. Let's get to April 27th, 1975. Before we go over the results, Ron, how did it do in comparison to the other Coliseum shows that you did before this one? Obviously, your long-term goal was to be in the Civic Coliseum every week. You weren't there yet. How did this one do compared to the previous two?
It was up again. The crowd was that kind of surprised me. I didn't expect it to be up again because we just ran 2 days before. That's unbelievable to do that and come back in 2 days and then that Coliseum crowd go up. It wasn't up a great deal, but it was up. And it was up. And the last time we were there was just a month earlier. So there were some really optimistic signs for me on that day about the future. The last Coliseum show had no wrestling in Knoxville for 9 days preceding the show, and it had two entire TVs to advertise it. This show only had 2 days since a Knoxville, live Knoxville event, and only one TV devoted to it. The crowd was only up, like I said, about 500. It was around 3,500 total fans. But the excitement of the crowd that afternoon seemed to be about double that of the second Coliseum show. The building was noticeably louder, and that was a surefire example to me that we were headed in the right direction. I listened to that crowd that night in the dressing room, and once I went to the ring, I felt like there was twice as many people in there as what there actually was. They were really, really into it. And that's exactly where I wanted to take things. I wanted to be able to go to the Coliseum and have that kind of reaction from the crowd, because it was a goosebump night for me on a couple of occasions where I really, really got into it. And the crowd was just crazy about that night.
Ron, before we get to the results, one last question. That was the optimistic feeling you had because you were slightly up. What if it had gone the other way? If you had been down 500 fans, if you had been down 1,000 fans, and again, a different layout. You didn't have 9 days this time. You had a show Friday night. You had TV Saturday. You had this show on Sunday afternoon, not Sunday evening, but Sunday afternoon. If the crowd had been down, would that have affected your long-term plans or no? Would you have said, you know what, maybe we shouldn't do the Coliseum, or were you still going full steam ahead with your idea of long-term being in the Coliseum?
That long-term was where my focus was. I didn't care. If we had been down, I wouldn't have let it bother me much, because there are a lot of other factors here that we haven't mentioned. That part of the country up there, when you get in late April, that's where we are in this time frame. A lot of people go to lakes there. It's just a beautiful part of the country to be outside. You've got the Smokies there. You've got the mountains. You've got the lakes. There's a lot of boating. It's that time of year. It's 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. I really kind of went there expecting it to be down a little bit. And when it was up a little bit, I was really, really pleased. It made me really feel better then. So the first match we had is Steve Kovacs. He showed up, but the British Butcher did not, but I knew he wasn't coming. I had noticed that he wasn't going to be able to make it, and I was able to get Crazy Luke Graham, who had wrestled Bobo Brazil in the last Coliseum show, to take the Butcher's place. They had a very entertaining time limit draw. Very decent first match, considering I don't know that those guys had ever worked with each other before. I think probably they had, though, because Luke had been in that territory along with Kovacs for a while. So they're bound to have had several matches. But they had a good match, opening match. Ron and Don Bass, managed by Sam Bass, they retained their Tennessee tag titles versus Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto. And that was a very good tag match. My brother and Jerry Briscoe had a super wrestling match. I mean, they're both baby faces. Jerry's not known as a heel at this point, and my brother's certainly not going to. I don't want him to heel in there. I want him to be a baby face. And I think his being a baby face makes a better heel out of me. So, I talked to him about it. I said, guys, I want a lot of wrestling. I really don't want a fist fight here. I don't want y'all to have any real violence much in the match. And they got the concept. Boy, and they had a fantastic wrestling match. And that's what I was hoping for out of those two guys, because I've been trying to sell wrestling, and you don't have the opportunity to have two guys with that kind of wrestling ability to go out there in front of a 3,500 people that they're not used to seeing that type of crowd in Knoxville and be able to do what they did so fabulously. Ron Wright won his match by disqualification. And obviously his match with the Stomper had all the violence that was necessary. It had no wrestling in it. It had total violence in it. And the fans really got into that too. Then along comes George Barnes and Bill Dundee, and they won the Southern Tag Championship match against Golden and Thatcher. And God, that was a barn burner. I watched that match myself. Wow. And they really got the crowd. And that's what Barnes and Dundee were good at. They were a great heel team. And Thatcher and Jimmy were making a great team together, too. Good combination. That match was excellent and tore the building down right before my match. I was like, wow, I'm going to have to go to follow this. It was up to that point, to the main event. I was very pleased with what had happened. And like I said, early matches I sat and could hear the crowd. I didn't hear that in the first two Coliseum shows. I didn't hear them react enough for me to be able to hear them in the dressing room. I could definitely hear this crowd in the dressing room.
Ron, before we get to the main event, I do want to ask you about something. So many people focus on Jack Briscoe, and of course he was an all-time great. He was an NWA world champion. But how good was Jerry? Do you think Jerry Briscoe gets the credit he deserves?
No, I don't. Jerry Briscoe is darn near as good a wrestler as Jack. Jerry was a little smaller than Jack. And I don't know, it seems like that happens a lot of times with brothers. Maybe not so much with the Funks. I mean, Terry's a little bigger maybe than Junior is. But, you know, that size and being a little bigger, in my case with Rob, fans, they gravitate to that big body type. Jerry being a little bit smaller than Jack affected him a little bit. But gosh, I think Jerry had tremendous success. Didn't make any difference where he went. He worked a lot of different territories and he got over great. Actually, in North Carolina, in Mid-Atlantic, he was fabulous over there. And I know that Jack went in there a lot of times because Jerry was over so good, and they would work into these tag situations and bring Jack in. And wow, they were doing big business over there in the Carolinas with Jerry Briscoe. And he was over darn good in Georgia at this point. He's over good enough to put the belt on him. So yeah, Jerry, in my opinion, was just about as good a worker as Jack was, just a little bit smaller. And I don't think that fans watched Jerry. He had a lot of fire, too. He was like Jack. Jack had a tremendous amount of fire as a babyface. And once he sold for you, once he made that comeback, he really got people. And so did Jerry. They were a great combination, together or separately. Those guys were really class acts.
Well, speaking of Jack, let's get to the main event. It's you against Jack Briscoe for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship.
That's it. And it got the best reaction yet from the 3,500-plus fans. You know, we wrestled a great deal of the match, and that match went probably about 45 minutes. I remember working his left arm for a great deal of that, maybe half the match. And Jack really put me over great. And every time I would lose that arm, he would get away from it. I would end up getting it back. And I was doing all kinds of dirty tactics, like getting outside the ring and dragging him to the corner and whipping his arm around the steel ring post. I did that to him several times. I would put his arm over the top rope and grab it and jump off the apron onto the floor. So, you know, was getting tremendous heat with wrestling. We weren't really having to get too far away from wrestling. And I really liked that, too. I didn't want us to get into having to bleed or get into that situation. It was a good, decent wrestling match, except I was using some heel tactics that kept that heat there for me. And for those that would like to see this match, it's one that's on YouTube. It's under 1975 NWA champion Jack Briscoe versus Ron Fuller. And if you watch it, I'd like for fans to just pay attention to the crowd noise in this match. That, to me, is what really got me the night we were having, the afternoon we had this match. And I watched a little bit of this one on YouTube myself, and I was like, wow, it sounds like 10,000 people rather than 3,500. So the phenomenal reaction, crowd reaction that day really made me feel very good about the future of my company. I was like, wow, these people are into it. And if we can get this to happen without having to fight and brawl and just wrestle, we're well on our way to where we want to go. At the end of the match, Jack gets a very good comeback on me in the corner, and the referee, and I'd built the heat really well. Jack sold like crazy, and once he started that comeback, I knew we were going to take the roof off the building at that point. And so Jack gets me in the corner, and he's pretty much beating the hell out of me, and the referee has to push him off me. And when the referee back was turned to me, and he's pushing Jack back, I reached in my tights and I got a piece of metal that I'd wrapped in white tape and then Jack, shoved the referee out of the way and charged in there, and I let him have it. I covered him in the middle of the ring, got a three count on him, beat the world champion right in the middle. And I was at that point the new world heavyweight champion, except for two things. One, I didn't have enough time to put my gimmick. And that's what we call those type of things. Wrestlers call those type of things your gimmick. I didn't have time to put my gimmick back into my tights, so I had to hide it underneath my left armpit. And the referee, when he comes to raise my hand, he's counted Jack out. He comes to raise my hand. He starts to raise my left hand, and I have to turn my body so that he raises my right hand. So he raises my hand in victory, and officially, in my mind, I am the new world heavyweight champion at that point. Then the second problem arrives in the ring, and that's the old number one hillbilly, Ron Wright, who had been back there watching the match, the entire match, and he comes and jumps into the ring while the referee goes to get me the belt, to hand me the belt. And as the referee starts to hand me the belt, I reach for my right hand. I still got my left hand kind of clamped down to my side because my gimmick's under there still. And Ron Wright grabs my left arm. He knows where it's there, and he lifts up my left arm, and the referee's about to hand me the belt, and out falls my gimmick onto the damn mat, and the referee's looking right at it. So he sees it fall to the mat, and he has him ring the bell again to disqualify me. Well, now Briscoe's still down. I mean, he's down for probably 3 minutes, maybe more. And I take the belt, but before I leave the ring, I nail that damned hillbilly and I pile drive him, man. I leave him laying. And then Jack's brother, Jerry, hits the ring to check on Jack, who's still down at that point. And then he tears into me. So I slide out with the world title belt and I head for the dressing room. It seemed like half the building was already at ringside after me, man. I mean, the heat was just unreal. It was a really, really hot finish. And everybody, even the second level and the third level of the building, they were coming down the staircases in the back and flooding out onto the main floor. And like I said, the heat was really, really hot. They finally got Jack back to his feet, but I still had the belt, and I was now in the dressing room by that point. Jack forced the referee. Later on, the referee told me, Jack says, go get my freaking belt, he can't keep my belt. So I think Mac Murray was actually the referee in this match, and Mac comes back to the dressing room, and he says, Jack says, get the belt. So I go, well, I guess so. So, he goes back. And so it was a very controversial ending to a world title match. And I filmed it, and I'm going to use that film for many weeks, because that film is going to stake my claim to being world champion for a while. I'm going to remind fans of what Ron Wright cost me, because he's in this film and he's the one that cost me to actually lose the world championship. And that finish kind of opens the door again for another program with Ron Wright, since he had been 8 weeks since he had worked with him. It had been 8 weeks since I'd worked with him in the second Coliseum show. And I know you, Brian, you're going to say, you know, how do you follow this big Coliseum card? Well, this is my angle right there. I got my angle right there to bring the old number one hillbilly back. He's actually gets involved. I got a film to show that I was world champion, except for that dummy. And he gets involved and causes me to lose it. And it all works out great for us to go back to the old Chilhowie Park again, because we're not in the Coliseum steady yet, but we're certainly working that direction. But again, sends us back to the park, being able to draw these houses and to continue the growth.
This seems like a perfect place to take a break, Ron. We will return in just a moment and finally hear the story of Ron's presentation for Knoxville's largest television station, WBIR, after these words about Super Studcast number 18, part one with Hands of Stone, Ron Garvin.
Since the release of Super Studcast number 13, the most popular Super Studcast so far about the Knoxville War of 1979, fans around the world have requested to hear the other side of the story. To Ron, no topic is taboo, and his fans get what they want. The Stud is proud to announce that one of the Knoxville Five, and highly regarded as an all-time great wrestler, will join him for Super Studcast number 18 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Fist of Stone, the original one-man gang and former NWA champion, Ronnie Garvin, shares his fantastic career accomplishments and his feelings about one of the most destructive wrestling wars in history. This historic Super Studcast number 18, now available, uncovers years of friendship, 6 months of conflict in 1979, and a forgiveness by both that measures the heart and soul of two really big men. This is exactly what Super Studcast are all about. Saddle up now for something remarkable at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for 3 unforgettable hours. Get them now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast.
There you hear it. Super Studcast number 18. Part one with Ron Garvin is available right now. We discuss so much, from breaking into the business, from wrestling in Montreal against the Rougeaus, from Ron Garvin's opinions of Dusty Rhodes, and this may be controversial, to so much more. We touch on every single area of his career. You need to check this out. Part one available right now, today, at patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com for only $2.99. You get in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. Check this show out today. We'll have more information later in the show. But Ron, we've been building it up. You've been teasing it for weeks. You need to get on a new TV station. You need it desperately. And you finally got your chance. Let's hear all about this meeting. Let's hear all about your presentation, your attempt to get on the biggest television station in Knoxville.
Yeah. And, you know, you've set it up very well, because it is. I kind of realized that I may be potentially could lose the TV I'm on. And this is the one I always wanted to be on since I came to town. And so this is an unusual thing for me. Bear in mind, I'm 27 years old. I have never sat down and made a presentation to a television station about putting my program on the air. So this was all new for me. And because I have no idea what to expect, you know, except for two conversations with Eddie Graham and one with my father, and their advice about what I should do and what I should say, what I should cover, and that type of thing. So as time goes by, I'm going to make a lot of these television station presentations in the future. But 14 years after this presentation, this presentation is kind of the start of preparing me to do these type of presentations almost every day when I'm going to change sports after my wrestling career is over and I'm going to get into hockey. I'm going to make these type of presentations to businesses and companies and big operations to try to get them to sponsor my hockey team. So this is the beginning for me to get my feet wet and to try to get the first television presentation that I ever make, try to get them to say yes. So, and I'm going to do this as best I can remember, Brian, pretty much exactly how I set this up. I guess that the people I was meeting this morning, that morning of April 28th, would want to hear my wrestling experience and history as well as my family's history. And I thought that they would want to know why and how I thought I could make my wrestling show a success on their station. They were likely going to want to see an example of how much better television wrestling show than the John Kazana one I had bought into. Just to see a real television show, basically. I was almost ashamed of the product that I was producing at the other TV because I had this problem with the commentator and everything else, pretty much everything else. I thought they'd probably want to know if I had any new ideas for my show that had never been done on anybody's wrestling show before. They were likely to be very interested in Arbitron and Nielsen ratings from markets similar to theirs, and maybe even markets larger than their market, to get a feel for the popularity and success of the sport in other parts of the country. I thought that would be important, that they realized that the wrestling they've seen in this town is not what it ought to be, and it's much better in a lot of other places. So, I figured that they're probably going to want to know my ideas for promoting this show, how to make it appeal to a larger audience, and what building I was planning to wrestle in if I was going to do this. Are we going to stay in Shell Alley Park, or are you going to maybe take it to the Coliseum? So I knew there were going to be a lot of other questions, and I should be prepared pretty much for anything. And that's the way I went into the meeting, trying to prepare myself for most anything. For all this information that they would desire, I turned, as I said, to my own experiences and called upon help from my great friends in Tampa. With Eddie Graham and my dad's blessing, Gordon Solie sent me a great championship wrestling from Florida show, a complete show, had a lot of wrestling in it. They sent me recent Arbitron and Nielsen books, which are rating books that everybody got from every television station. And they sent them for three markets, for Tampa, Miami, and Tallahassee. And I asked for Tallahassee specifically because it was a comparable market to Knoxville in size. So they sent it all to me within 2 days. Gordon was so professional, as always. And so on the morning of April the 28th, 1975, I arrived in my best suit at the television station 15 minutes early at 9:45 for my appointment. I had my entire presentation typed out and copied for five people. I had no idea what to expect when it came to the number of management people or whoever would be in this meeting. But I felt like five was a good number. I actually hoped it wouldn't be more than five. I was hoping for a small group, and it didn't happen like that. But I didn't let it bother me at all. So they come down at 10 o'clock. Lady Pick comes and gets me out of the lobby, and she takes me upstairs, the second floor, and I enter this beautiful conference room. My goodness, it was fabulous. Big, long desk with TV monitors built into the walls, and it was filled. Every chair was filled, and they were all members of the management. I never counted them. I didn't really have the time, but there must have been at least 10 of them at this big, long table. And after meeting, I went around the table just like I would as a wrestler and introduced myself. I'd never been done. Like I said, this was my first time. I'd never had one of these meetings. So I just played like I would have been going into a territory with a bunch of guys I'd never met. And I introduced myself, shook every hand, asked what you do. And they started telling me what departments they ran. So after shaking everybody's hand, and I was shown to the seat at the end of the table. At the far end of the table was the general manager for the station. And I was kind of amazed that he brought all these people in. I didn't know, am I going to be able to speak to these people individually in a way that's going to be important for them? I didn't even understand why would he want all of this input back from these people, but I was there to do my thing. So, And he sits down as soon as I have a seat. The first thing out of his mouth, he says, "How can we help you?" Wow. I mean, you know, I can't even explain how pleased I was to hear that first question from the GM. And once I got that question, I was ready to roll with it, man. I was going to go after it at that point. There were no ladies at the table. So I began with the gentleman. After having the same old wrestling show and company in this area for far too many years, I'm here to offer you an opportunity to associate yourselves with an up-and-coming new wrestling company in this market. I'm a member of the oldest and largest wrestling family in the world. I'm a third-generation wrestler and the owner of the new Southeastern Wrestling Company in Knoxville. I'm the new man in town, and I've been here for only 6 months. During that short time, I have increased crowds at Chilhowie Park by 40%, and yesterday afternoon presented the third Coliseum show ever in only my first 6 months in Knoxville. I figure let's just start right out and try to get them really involved and to give them an idea of who I am and where I'm going. And I just continued on. I told them I grew up as an athlete. I was All-State in basketball in Georgia and went on to play basketball on scholarship at Clemson University and the University of Miami. I studied marketing and I told them I daily use my training and education for my own business. I didn't just study marketing because I felt like I had to study something. I studied it purposely because I felt like if I got in this position, I was going to need that type of training. I began wrestling professionally, I told them, in 1970, and I've wrestled in many major markets in this country, as well as throughout the Caribbean and in Australia. I told them my father and grandfather have both been wrestlers and owners of wrestling companies in this state, in Tennessee. My grandfather, Roy Welch, has been in Nashville since the 1930s, has developed and created one of the largest territories in all of wrestling anywhere in the world. And my father, Buddy Fuller, has been in Memphis in the late 50s, where he put together and put wrestling on the map with WHBQ-TV there in 1958. I felt it was important to kind of let them know that I knew something about the other side of the state, and I know that, and then I pushed them toward doing their homework now. I said, it might be a station that you would like to take a look at, I told them, since it's one of the many TV stations in the state of Tennessee with wrestling programs, and theirs is one of the best-rated wrestling programs in America in the last 16 years since my dad started it on WHBQ. So I laid that foundation as best I could. And I just continued on with it from there. I said, gentlemen, rather than tell you about what I know and have experienced in televised wrestling, I have brought a recent TV show from the state of Florida that will tell you much more than I can. I said, this is an example of what is happening in most major markets around the USA when it comes to televised wrestling. And you will quickly recognize that it is nothing like John Kazana's show on one of your competitor stations. I wasn't backing away from the fact that, I'm there now and I'm on that and I'm in that position and I'm having to operate on that station, but it's not what I like. I held up the tape and one of the men got up from the table and disappeared into another room to get it set up. I continued. I've also brought 5 copies of the proposal that I will make today, I said. The GM at the far end of the table told one of the guys there to make copies and pass them around. And I just continued on. I didn't stop. I had some momentum going. So I said, I don't know if you are aware or not, but I purchased the rights to Knoxville 6 months ago from John Kazana and have been operating wrestling here under the name of Southeastern Wrestling. I found this opportunity here during a vacation when I watched one of Mr. Kazana's wrestling shows on a competing station. That's the station I'm on today. Having traveled, seen, and appeared on many wrestling shows in America and other countries, I have to admit the Kazana show did not impress me. I was actually amazed that anyone was still in business with such an inferior product. And that is why I became interested in this market, because he was somewhat successful in spite of a very poor product. Obviously, this is wrestling country, I told him. I believe that the word wrestling is really what the sport is all about, and I saw very little of it on his show that day. Due in great part to its commentator, who appeared to be forcing the show toward being a comedy. My goal is to create a wrestling show in this market that will set the standard for studio wrestling shows, not just here, but around the world. I'm sure that many of you have seen pieces of John Cazana's production, and I must assure you there's nothing on any of those shows that I would even allow on mine, including their outrageous commentator. The tech that set up the Florida tape for viewing came back in, and assuming he was ready with the show, I asked if they would like to see some of what a quality wrestling show looked like. I was burning poor Cazana, but, you know, I was being very honest. The championship wrestling from Florida show had a good opening, great-looking set, and obviously it went straight to Gordon Sully. The sound was running during their watching it, and I kept quiet, and I spent the next few minutes intently watching the reactions of those around the table. The first match featured Jack Briscoe, and it had a lot of wrestling in it. Then the show returned to the desk with Gordon Sully, and he called for a recent match from Miami that was very impressive because mainly it showed thousands of fans. It was a typical Miami, and they were still doing good business down there. And, you know, it had thousands of fans in attendance. It was impressive. I felt pretty good when several of them started looking at each other as if they were asking the question without being able to say it, is this what a real wrestling show looks like? I kind of thought, well, they've been here for a long, long time. This is all they've ever seen is what Cazana's been giving them. And I was just thinking, you know, the way they were looking at each other, they were like, wow, this is good. Wow. They, you know, so the GM asked to have the tape forwarded, and they watched an interview segment done with class and no screaming from the commentator or references to warp your head off holes or anything like that. You know, and the GM, after a few more minutes, said, OK, that's enough. They had basically seen enough. So I continued on, man. I didn't let anything, I didn't hesitate. I quickly passed around the Arbitron and the Nielsen rating books from the three Florida markets with the proper pages already exposed and called attention to the highlighted numbers concerning the Tampa, Miami, and Tallahassee markets. All three markets had shares above 50%. That means that more than half of the entire number of people watching TV at that time were watching wrestling. Again, I watched their faces and reactions closely, and I was feeling pretty good about things, but there was very little as far as questions from any of them, and that concerned me somewhat. You know, nobody had asked anything about it. And then right as soon as I finished, I got my first question from the GM, just about as soon as that last thought had crossed my mind that I'm not getting asked any question. And he stopped me and he said, Mr. Fuller, why do you think you could make wrestling on this station a success? And exactly how would you do that? Wow. And that's that's what I'd prepared for. So I just kept rolling. I said, let's start with the why part of your question. You're located in a part of the country that has phenomenal potential for fans to watch the sport. Your station's tremendous signal provides unlimited opportunity to reach great numbers in more than one state, and the states where you can be seen are filled with potential wrestling fans. The former owner here, John Cazana, had no interest in trying to cultivate an educated audience. I believe that wrestling here can and will have fans from all walks of life, from all different occupations and educational backgrounds, from the hills of Kentucky into the halls of the University of Tennessee that's downtown here. This sport can attract people of all economic backgrounds and educational levels if presented properly. The name on the marquee is wrestling, and if you give them lots of that, fans will appear from everywhere. I've witnessed that myself in traveling and wrestling throughout the country and in other countries. This sport is filled with great talent, and very little of it has ever been here. The quick question to the answer, why can I do it, is that I have a plan, unlike the former owner. Provide the best wrestlers. Produce the best wrestling program that offers a quality production and quality commentators, and engage the entire community. Get every potential wrestling fan out there to start watching the show. And I just barreled ahead. As far as the question, how I would do it, I have a plan for that as well. The former owner here had no plans to try developing markets in surrounding cities. I will make that happen. And the mere fact that we will take the sport to the smaller cities will intensify the interest in the sport. It will also substantially increase your audience as well, which I felt was important. They're in it to have big audience and to make money by selling it. And I really wanted to strike that point that they would substantially increase their audience as well, since my research so shows that there are more people living outside of Knoxville in your signals range than live in the city. So I will promote live events 5 nights a week into 4 different states where you are presently viewed. I want to be the first in wrestling to create and innovate so many new things into the TV show itself. I will design and produce a quality set and an opening to the show that will be unique and worthy of the production to follow it. I am here because I know you produce quality programming, and I want to take advantage of that fact. Here is how I will do it. All of the following ideas are new. Everything I'm about to tell you has never been done on any other wrestling studio show in the world. I want to have instant replay, not just once a show, but after every match. I want to utilize split screen ability as much as possible so fans can see and focus on two areas of the ring simultaneously and see the sport in a totally new way. I want to do a 5-minute segment each show called Personality Profile that highlights one wrestler each week, but has little or nothing to do with wrestling. It will expose wrestlers' backgrounds and interests that don't have to be wrestling associated. Basically, I want to tear the standard wrestling show format apart and create a totally new way of presenting the sport. I will also help drive numbers for the station by spending my own money to promote not just the sport, but your station as well, where they can find wrestling every Saturday. I'm a strong believer in advertise, and I will utilize everything from newspaper ads, wrestling posters, radio, freeway billboards. And when I do, your station will be on every form of advertising because you will be wrestling in this market. I want WBIR TV Channel 10 to be recognized and synonymous with the sport. I will, as our presence in the market grows, become more involved with all aspects of the community and use my wrestlers to promote and work charitable events everywhere. A good example is your Jerry Lewis Telethon on Labor Day every year. I will gladly provide my wrestlers free of charge for those shows and others to support the community. I will take the sport big time, and the goal is to eventually take wrestling to the Coliseum every Friday night. We will, if you take my show, become by far the largest drawing event in the Coliseum's history. By accessing that venue, we will suddenly interest an entirely new audience that will take us mainstream. We will strive to appeal to everyone from a farmer in the Smokies to a professor at the University of Tennessee. Our audience soon will begin to broaden in scope and explode in numbers. The final part of how I can change things is basically based upon my family's 50 years in the sport. We know practically every meaningful wrestler in the world, where to find them, and most importantly, how to get them. I will bring the best wrestlers to this market that have ever been here. With your help, We will make this city one of the wrestling capitals of the world. If you join me, I believe those 50% plus shares you saw in those recent Arbitron and Nielsen books from Florida will be blown away by shares in the 70s or better. At that point, the GM excused everybody at the desk, but the sales manager and the production manager. With just the four of us at the desk, he began, "Mr. Fuller, your presentation has been very interesting. I want to discuss with you and allow these other two key people to hear this part of the conversation what our arrangement would be like if we decided to do this with you. Bear in mind the word if." I didn't care about the if. I was ecstatic to get this far. Luckily, I discussed with both Eddie and my father how things worked in their experience with arrangements to get on TV stations. I was hopeful to get this far and to have the opportunity and very happy to discuss it. I knew what I wanted and decided quickly to put my proposal on the table first. I began again. "Let's start with the production of the show. I don't care if you wish to televise live, but the show would need to be taped for my expansion into other markets. I know that most stations across America that produce wrestling programs cover that production cost. You will be my originating station as I expand into other markets. I will need you to cut interviews for other markets and insert them into the current show's tape before distributing them weekly to those stations in the other markets. I will cover the tape cost as well as the shipping cost of getting them to every station if you will cover the production cost. I know that 16 minutes out of every 60-minute program is set aside for commercials. I will split those 16 minutes with you. I get 8 minutes to advertise my live events, and you get 8 minutes of commercial time to sell. I will pay all costs associated with wrestlers, referees, announcers, commentators, ring setup, takedown each week, if you will take care of all production expenses." The GM looked at both the other two, turned back to me, and he finally had a few things to say himself. He said, first thing out of his mouth, he said, "You must have done this many times before." I was like, wow. I was kind of flattered. He says, "Your proposal is a very solid one, and I think the production and commercial split are reasonable. But I must speak with these two gentlemen regarding everything we have talked about today before I can give you an answer. The production you have described is a complicated one and will require a Saturday production staff that we don't normally bring in here. We will make a decision and give you an answer by this Friday." 5 days later, I was very pleased, felt pretty comfortable that there was a good chance this would happen, especially since he asked how we would set up the deal. I had other questions and suggestions, and since he still seemed very interested, I just ventured on while the fire was hot. I asked about how they would promote the new wrestling show if they took it. When he started to answer that question, I pretty well knew he was in. I knew I had it. He said, "If we do this, we're 100% in, and under no circumstances will we allow this to fail. We will commit to a huge block of promos around the clock to begin at least 2 weeks prior to the show debut. We will also work with you personally as a spokesman for your wrestling show. And after meeting you, I personally feel that you would be perfect, the perfect personality to get us to where you say you want to be. We only want the best here on our station, and I think you have ideas that will make your show the best. I do have one more important question for you." I said, "Okay, what's that question, obviously?" And he asked, "Who will be your commentator or commentators?" And, it was the big Jim. There was the big Jim Hess question without mentioning his name. And obviously right then I thought to myself, this GM had been doing his homework and he'd seen enough of Big Jim probably in one day. And I had sure seen enough of Big Jim. So I told him that it would definitely not be the current commentator of the show on the other station. I went on to say I had a very good wrestler friend that was excellent at speaking in public and had some experience in Charlotte, North Carolina with interviews and commentary for the wrestling company there. I also told him that the guy I was considering and that he and I had been working on the ideas I presented today for at least 3 months. He thanked me for coming, shook hands with all three of them, left with a great sense of possible success, went home and immediately called Les Thatcher and described the meeting. We were both as excited as kids on the last day of school. I changed my clothes, got my wrestling bag, headed for the airport for my flight to Memphis to wrestle Jack Briscoe again, the second title shot in 2 days.
Well, Ron, this is a great place to end this week's episode, and I can't wait to hear where this is going next. You're building up to something with Big Jim Hess, and I think we all know eventually you're going to move away from him, but we can't wait to hear when exactly it happens. But as we wrap things up, want to remind everyone, you can follow the Tennessee Stud on Facebook, the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. All you have to do is like that page, and boom, you are friends with a wrestling legend. Once again, the Facebook page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter, at Ron Fuller Welch. Once again, we want to remind you, don't miss part one of the latest Super Studcast number 18, with Fists of Stone, Ronnie Garvin. Of course, you may know him as the One Man Gang. He has many nicknames, and we're going to talk all about those, how he got those nicknames, and his entire career in part one of this amazing Super Studcast. And we're going to open the door to part two, and we're going to talk a little bit about the controversial Knoxville Wrestling War of 1979, but you're going to hear much, much more about that in part two. You need to check this out right now, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. For only $2.99, you get in the door, and thank you to all the patrons, especially the ones who are at tiers above $2.99. We really do appreciate everyone supporting this production each and every week. Thank you to all the patrons of the Studcast, and thank you to everyone who listens to the regular Studcast. We appreciate the entire audience, especially all the new people that have just recently jumped on board. Want to remind you also, you can follow me on Twitter at GreatBrianLast. You can also follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at SuperPodcast. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk, and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. Now, Ron, this is usually the part of the show where I ask you, where are we going next week? But next week's show will be episode 100 of the Studcast, and I know that you have a special surprise for all the Studcast listeners for next week's show. Why don't you tell us what that is?
Well, Brian, as you're aware, next week is the 100th episode, obviously, and it's going to be a very special one. It'll be the first time ever we're going to do an hour and a half regular Studcast. Not been done before. Just because it's the 100th edition, I thought that made some sense to provide them with a little more time. And in order to fill that time, I have invited my brother and my cousin Jimmy Golan, and the three of us Welches are going to take this one, and we're going to run with it for an hour and a half. We're going to raise some hell here next week as we talk about where we are in the Studcast time frame of 1977. Roberts just had his first match for Southeastern and a great win over Jerry Briscoe in this very episode that we just had here. And Jimmy's well on his way to becoming a star in the Southeast. So it's a special hour and a half with all three of us together live for the first time. We've not done that before. And I just want fans to please join us for this. It's an hour and a half long. And it's my way of saying thanks for all these fans around the world that have jumped on board of the Studcast and ride with us each week. And I just want to thank them for saddling up. And next week on number 100, it'll be a great one for them to saddle up for.
That sounds like a major show. It sounds like a Super Studcast. But, of course, it will be a regular Studcast, the 100th episode spectacular, next week. But until then, I want to remind you that Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story will continue next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.